630 AM, W255 DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Special Report. Iran has retaliated against the U.S. for the attacks on its nuclear facilities over the weekend. It fired several short to medium range missiles at a U.S. base in Qatar. CBS's Charlie Daggett at the Pentagon.
This is not only one of the biggest bases, but it's also one of the best defended. It might be symbolic that the Iranians are saying, look, we're going to hit you right where you live, right at your central command.
Margaret Brennan reports the attack was not unexpected.
The United States and Qatar were able to be in communication well in advance of the attack actually being launched to prepare for what was about to come.
Foreigners had been ordered to shelter in place. The U.S. says there were no American casualties. CBS's Holly Williams.
If it indeed was a calibrated, almost a theatrical response, then do we also see diplomatic wheels turning? Do we see Iran capitulating or at least agreeing to curtail its nuclear program? Or does this potentially spiral out of control?
CBS News Special Report. I'm Cammie McCormick.
For WXCO News, I'm Brittany Merlot. High heat and humidity still rage with heat advisories remaining through tonight. The heat index will once again reach the low 100s. And now the threat of severe weather moves in. And the Storm Prediction Center has us in a slight risk. We've got a cold front that is sweeping across the state, which is the reason why thunderstorms are going to become more numerous and widespread. And by tonight, it looks to line up and pack the risk of high winds, which could gust up to 70 miles per hour, causing some scattered damage. It's also going to cool our temperatures down as it stalls over the state, which is going to bring some heavy rainfall and training storms, raining down over the same area over and over again, causing the potential for flooding later this week. Widespread inch of rain is expected, and a good 3 to 5 inches is possible in spots by the end of this week. So stay dry and don't forget the umbrella. Also, be on the lookout for pavement buckling today. Lisa Hale explains.
When weather conditions go from cool to extremely hot quickly, the slabs of pavement in the road could begin to expand and push against each other. If the pressure gets high enough, the pavement can buckle and create an unexpected bump or dip in the road. Residents should remember to buckle up, keep their eyes on the road, and watch for slowing traffic and roadside workers.
And the Wisconsin State Assembly voted unanimously to increase penalties for people found guilty of sextortion last week. Named Braden's Law in memory, the law would allow sextortion perpetrators to be charged with felony murder if their victim commits suicide. The charges that would most accurately apply to the crime currently include a maximum sentencing of only 3.5 years. And the legislation is now with the state Senate, appears likely to advance to Governor Tony Evers. I'm Brittany Merlot for WXCO.
The Brewers are back home. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, baseball, the Milwaukee Brewers and Pittsburgh Pirates. Beginning a 3-game series at American Family Field tonight, the Brewers went from a 9-3 lead over the Twins yesterday to a 9-8 win, thanks to closer Trevor McGill, manager Pat Murphy.
When leverage guys come in with a big margin, sometimes things are different. That's kind of the story of that. But they held it together, and McGill was terrific. You know, McGill was terrific.
NBA, Kevin Durant traded to the Houston Rockets in a blockbuster deal with the Phoenix Suns. The Oklahoma City Thunder, 103-91, to win their first NBA title. The Pacers' Tyrese Halliburton suffering a torn Achilles in the first quarter. Racing, Alex Palou winning the XPEL Grand Prix at Road America on a very hot day at Elkhart Lake.
It was a crazy race. It was a crazy race for us. At moments, I thought we were losing a ton of positions and we were making. It was a tough race for everybody.
That's Indy driver Alex Palou with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Reach, engage, grow with Civic Media. Log on civicmedia.us/advertise.
A severe thunderstorm watch has been issued. Storms are expected to bring torrential, heavy downpours, the possibility of hail and damaging high wind gusts, which could reach up to 60 to 70 miles per hour, and a tornado or two is also possible. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. It's 77 degrees at our studios.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
Todd Michaels joins us now.
I have to give a shout out to Oshkosh. It's a very underrated city.
There was also a restaurant there I really liked. I don't think it's there anymore.
Yeah, the Tally's was great. I may have gone to like a prom dinner there or something like that back in my day too, Pete.
A little calzone before you tear it up in the dance floor.
Man, there's nothing better than wearing a tuxedo and a little calzone in your cummerbund.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Matt and Air on Air.
From articles that I have seen, if you are a bagel purist, you should not toast your bagel. I think nothing's better than a toasted bagel and a schmear.
Folks, can we have a moment of honesty? Do you really like bagels, or do you like the schmear that is transported by them? Get rid of the stigma. If I walk into this room eating cream cheese out of a tub with a spoon.
Why is that wrong?
Matt and Air on Air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Maggie Dawn.
LGBTQ rights are under attack. At 4:30, Patrick Faribault from Our Lives Magazine joins to discuss what's at stake and how we celebrate Pride right here in Wisconsin. Don't miss the Maggie Dawn Show.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays 4 till 6. This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO.
From the Civic Media World Headquarters in Madison, Wisconsin, it's the Todd Albaugh Show. And now, pursuing truth wherever it may lead, here's your host, Todd Albaugh.
Everybody, I'm Todd Albaugh here at the world headquarters of Civic Media in downtown Madison, Wisconsin, along with our producer, engineer Aaron Zommers and Parker Olson. Glad to have you along here on a very busy Monday, June 23rd, 2025. I have breaking news to start the show. Later on, we'll have State Senator Keldon Royce talking about the Joint Finance Committee and breaking news from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in regards to cuts there. And also in hour number two, Matt DeFore, the State Bureau Chief of Wisconsin Watch, will be in talking about AI and newsmaking. But first, we begin with the breaking news of the day here in downtown Madison, but around the world, according to CBS News and others. A couple of hours ago, Iran said today that it has launched attacks on the U.S. Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar 2 days after the U.S. struck 3 nuclear sites in Iran. Explosions were heard in Qatar as witnesses said they saw what appeared to be missiles over the country, according to multiple news agencies. Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said it targeted the U.S. air base at Al Udeid in Qatar with a, quote, devastating and powerful missile, unquote. Iranian state media earlier today announced an operation launching missiles attacks against U.S. bases named, quote, Annunciation of Victory, unquote. The U.S. defense official confirmed that the base was attacked by short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles originating from Iran today. At this time, U.S. officials say there are no reports of U.S. casualties. They said officials are monitoring the situation closely and will provide more information as it becomes available. Joining us to discuss these latest developments today and also over the weekend, we appreciate him being with us. He was with us on this breaking news over the weekend on Saturday. We so appreciate it. Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco, joins us now live via StreamYard. Professor, once again, thank you so much for taking your time.
Good to be with you again.
It's a busy day, to say the least. So you joined us over the weekend at these initial U.S. strikes against Iran. What do you make today? Because I think last time we talked, and many people, as you watched the morning news shows yesterday and other things, the apprehension seemed to stem around what was, and I think most people agree, there was going to be some sort of Iranian response here. What do you make of this response in Qatar today? We are reporting is that the Iranian government gave the Qatari government a heads up to let them know, hey, we're just targeting U.S. bases. What do you make of this response today?
Well, in certain ways, it's a relief because it does seem to be a limited attack. And it certainly, Trump's position was basically, we just bombed you. Now we want peace. You know, I mean, you can only imagine, you know, somebody going to a bar and punching somebody else and say, oh, I want peace now.
Right, it's all over now.
You don't, it's your fault, you know. But and Trump indeed said there'd be a massive retaliation. You know, they we'd bomb them like they'd never seen before, far worse than they've gotten from Israel, da da da. And so and one couldn't imagine again that Iran would not respond in some way. So here is the question: how are they going to respond? Is it going to be in a manner that you know, Trump would go ahead and do the massive bombing and things escalate, go out of control, the Strait of Hormuz would be closed, interrupting the oil supply and the ripple effects in the global economy, and all sorts of people killed, and you know, I mean, there are all sorts of you know, terrible scenarios that we're considering. But it seems like the Iranian government is basically taking a middle ground. Again, they couldn't just roll over and not respond, but by doing it in such a way that they warn people ahead of time, and that the amount of missiles that came over were actually fairly small. Now, the Israelis have done a lot of damage to Iran's military capability, but they still have a lot of missiles. They could have done a swarm attack. They could have killed a fair number of Americans, not just in Qatar, but in Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Iraq. We have like 40,000 troops within just a couple hundred miles of the Iranian border, not to mention our ships in the Gulf. And, you know, so if they were really out to kill a bunch of Americans, they could have done it. And so this is it's real relief, you know, that they did not go to the more maximalist response that they could have done, both in terms of the fact that there aren't, you know, large scale American casualties, but also it will reduce the likelihood that the United States will respond in turn and have things spiral out of control.
To help us to understand, and I, you know, I wish we had an entire afternoon to do one of your classes. I took, you know, Middle Eastern history back in high school years and years ago. I find it a fascinating region of the world. Certainly a lot of, I think most Americans would look at it as a lot of chaos. It's very complicated, hard to understand. Help break this down for those of us here in Wisconsin that might not understand this part of the world as well as you do, Professor, in terms of, the Iranians have had a problem with Americans for a long, long time. Those of us old enough for us to remember the hostage situation during the 1980 presidential election between Carter and Reagan, and ever since then. And take us, if you can, Ken, a little bit from that. Give me a couple of minute background. I know it's way too short a time, but a couple of minute background, and then up to how that ties into what the Obama administration, maybe it started W. Bush, I'm not sure, but the Obama administration, Trump 1, Biden, now Trump 2, about trying to have inspectors in Iran. There were negotiations going on, and the difference between that and the enrichment for Iranians to make a bomb and why that's important. We could come back and spend more time on it, but that's kind of the context I'd like you to help us understand, if you'd be so very kind.
Well, I'd like to start a little further back, actually.
Sure, in please.
Fact, way back. I mean, Iran, formerly known as Persia, has been a major regional power for like 2,500 years. Mm-hmm. You know, so they don't like being treated like some Caribbean island or Central American country where the U.S. can basically, you know, send in the Marines or whatever and make them do what they want to do. There's a lot of national pride. Now, most Iranians do not like their government, but, you know, they are very proud of their culture. Any of your listeners who know anyone of Persian background knows, you know, the pride in their heritage, in their history. And they don't like being jerked around. They don't like being told that, oh, Israel can have nuclear weapons. Pakistan have nuclear weapons. India have nuclear weapons. We can have nuclear weapons. But Iran, you can't even have a civilian program that has the potential down the road of becoming weaponized. Mm-hmm. And so that stirs up a lot of national sentiments. You don't have to be a, you know, supporter of the Ayatollah or anything like that. Say, hey, wait a minute, you know, this isn't really fair. And there's concern about the history of the U.S. I mean, they're back in 1953, they had a nationalist prime minister who seized the British oil companies that were exploiting the wealth of the nation without giving hardly anything in return. There are big international sanctions. And the U.S. Came in, the CIA came in and overthrew the elected prime minister. And they brought back from exile the Shah, that's basically the Persian word for emperor, who ruled as an absolute monarch, quite brutal. His Savak, the dreaded secret police that were trained by the United States, tortured and murdered many tens of thousands of people. And it was the United States that said, hey, this is a great ally here. Why don't we help them develop nuclear power? So this is an important piece to note, that it was the United States that started Iran's nuclear program. Mm. And when the Shah's regime was so effective at wiping out the leftist and nationalist and liberal and secular opposition, but they couldn't completely get into the mosques. And so when they had the revolution, it took on a strong Islamist characterization, practically pretty reactionary Islamist characterization, which is a little unusual because the Iranians, compared to a lot of predominantly Muslim countries, have not been super religious, ultra conservative, whatever. So it was a real shock to go from a more secular authoritarian regime to a religious authoritarian regime.
Right.
And they didn't have one of the first things the new regime did was they abolished the nuclear program. However, when Iraq invaded in the 1980s, used chemical weapons on a massive scale, and the world didn't respond, there are some Iranians said, maybe we need to redevelop nuclear power and at least have an option of developing a nuclear weapon to protect ourselves as a deterrent. So again, this is important to emphasize that, to those Iranians who did think about wanting maybe get a nuclear bomb, maybe that being an option in the future, it was not to destroy Israel or the United States. It was why most countries have a nuclear deterrent. And so especially when the U.S. invaded the countries to their immediate east and west, Afghanistan and Iraq, when you saw them listed as the axis of evil along with Iraq and North Korea, and when Iraq got rid of their nuclear program and got invaded anyway, and North Korea developed nuclear weapons, they're still in power. Maybe there's a lesson there. Maybe you do need some kind of deterrent. But again, there's no evidence they're actually going to develop a bomb. Even having that potential got a lot of people concerned, given the nasty nature of the regime. Despite their anti-imperialist rhetoric, they've engaged in quite a few imperialist machinations themselves in the region. Mm-hmm. And again, I think most listeners know it is, like I say, a pretty nasty regime. But they did agree under Obama to eliminate a huge portion of their nuclear program.
Right.
It reduced its number of centrifuges to enrich uranium to a little more than 5,000, which is far below the number needed to process uranium to the 90% level needed for nuclear weapons. In fact, they agreed to, they eliminated 98% of their nuclear stockpile. They restricted the level of enrichment to 3.67 percent. They decommissioned the Iraq reactor, which could produce plutonium. They allowed inspectors to look at everything from mining and milling, conversion, enrichment, fuel manufacturing, nuclear reactors, spent fuel, everything. One of the most comprehensive inspections regimes ever, and they were abiding by it, 100%. But despite that,
not to interrupt, but they had the deal was, correct me if I'm wrong, you had to have UN or inspectors were from neither country go in,
third party to
verify this.
And everybody thought, oh, this nuclear crisis, everybody's been freaking out for years, is over. It took a decade of posturing, 2 years of intense negotiations. I met with the Iranian foreign minister actually in 2019 when I was in Tehran, and he talked about how he had less than 50 one-on-one meetings with John Kerry, the then U.S. Secretary of State, going over the agreement line by line by line. And then Trump comes in, and even though Iran was totally abiding by it, he threw it out and said, "Oh, I can negotiate a better deal." And of course, he didn't. And this is not some real estate thing, So Iran said, "Okay, if you're not going to go by the deal, we don't have to either," because by pulling out of the deal, United States imposed these really draconian sanctions on Iran, and part of it was that they would punish any government or a company that didn't go with the sanctions as well. Mm-hmm. So that meant a lot of other countries and everything. So it ended up really hurting the economy, and the Iranians destroyed billions of dollars worth of equipment in return for lifting the sanctions. And the U.S. said, too bad, it's over. And so And here's the thing. This is, I can't emphasize this enough.
You know what? I'm going to stop. This is called a tease, Professor, because we're up against the clock. So if you want to know the key thing that Professor Zunes is going to tell us, stick around for 2 minutes. You'll find it out on the other side. Professor Stephen Zunes of University of San Francisco helping us break down this breaking news as Iran has attacked or attempted to attack U.S. military bases in Qatar. It's the Todd Allball Show for a Monday. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to Across Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, Wausau's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
An unsuspecting driver at a gas station in Wisconsin.
Welcome, Paul 15. How you doing?
Great.
Were you wearing your seatbelt today?
I never wear my seatbelt.
We're going to get him. We're going to get him real good.
Oh, my goodness.
Hello, sir. How you doing? Dollar driver. It takes 1 second to strap a seatbelt on. Well, let's do this. Let's do it together. Now, don't that feel better?
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Click it or tick it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways.
And I should have recognized your voice when you're harassing
me. I'm watching you.
Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
Wausau American Legion Post 10 Softball is on 98.9 WXCO, online at WXCO.fm. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Our next broadcast will be on Wednesday when Post 10 takes on Tomahawk. Hear all the exciting action starting with the pregame show at 6:20 and the first pitch at 6:30. Wausau Post 10 American Legion Softball on 98.9 WXCO is brought to you by American Family Insurance, Jamie Schley Agency, Featherstone Cabinetry, Priceless Building Center, and Edward Jones Investments, Peter Gunn. It's Wausau taking on Tomahawk in American Legion softball. Wednesday, starting with the pregame show at 6:20, first pitch at 6:30. On your home for high school play-by-play, 98.9 WXCO, online at WXCO.fm. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app.
In sitcoms, when someone has a problem, they just blurt it out and move on.
Well, I lost my job and my parakeet is missing. How was your day?
But the real world is different. Managing life's challenges can be overwhelming. So, what do? We get support. The Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council have mental health resources available for you at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. See how much further you can go when you take care of your mental health.
Is getting vaccinated on your to-do list? We can help you check that off.
You've got this.
Yes, you do. See how we've got you at yougotthis.usaging.org. A message from the Aging and Disability Vaccination Collaborative, powered by U.S. Aging.
Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network across the state of Wisconsin. Glad to have you along on a Monday, June 23rd, 22 minutes now past the hour of 2 o'clock as we continue to follow breaking news at this hour. Iran said that it has launched an attack on the U.S. Air Force, of the U.S. base, rather, Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, just 2 days after the U.S. Struck three nuclear sites there. So far, no word of any U.S. casualties. It seems that so far, reports are the interceptor type of missiles have stopped those ballistic short and mid-range reported missiles from actually landing on the U.S. airbase here. Here to help us sort through all of this, we appreciate it so very much, joining us live via StreamYard from San Francisco, Stephen Zunes, the professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Professor, again, thank you so very much. We're up against the clock. The computer cuts me off, whether I want to or not, so that's why I had to stop you. And you're just about, you're giving us the history here, and this is a fantastic history of why things are the way they are to a degree. And you got to the point of saying that in recent times, now under Obama, then into Trump one term, that there was this deal of to have the Iranians basically supervised or inspected is probably a better word to make sure they weren't enriching their uranium and creating a nuclear bomb. It worked pretty well. And then Trump canceled the deal. And you said, mm-hmm. Here's the important thing to remember. Please go ahead.
Yeah, the important thing to remember is that when you hear Trump and other Republicans, as well, for that matter, as leading Democrats, Schumer and Jeffries and Schiff and Rosen and Fetterman and others who have been supporting Israel's war on Iran, they're saying we must prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon. Okay, fine. I don't want them to have a nuclear weapon either. Right. But they don't say, then let's return to the Iran nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're saying, let's go to war. So it's not an issue of whether or not someone believes Iran should develop a nuclear weapon. It's that you want to do it through diplomacy, which had already been successful. Mm-hmm. Or do you want to go to war with, you know, not only the horrific casualties that have been going on in both Iran and Israel, and now with the U.S. involved and the risk of something much larger. I mean, again, so this is the real issue that a lot of people, both the Republicans and the Democratic hawks, mm-hmm. seem to be ignoring. So, if you really don't want Iran to get a nuclear weapon, go back to the treaty that made it the agreement that made it impossible. Especially since it's unclear, despite Trump's claims, whether they actually did destroy everything.
Right.
They could rebuild, and even though they've killed some top scientists, they got plenty of more scientists. Right. And if anything is going to make Iran motivated, maybe we do need a nuclear deterrent so this won't happen again.
So help me explain, or help me understand this, Professor Zunez, and we got about 5 minutes here left. Just from a cultural, we hear this, quote unquote, death to America, that for, as it's explained by some religious reasons, that the Iranians are never going to give up because they believe in this almost religious thing where Israel and the U.S. has to be wiped off the face of the map to accomplish religious goals, I guess I'll put it in those terms. Complete bunk, or what is that?
That's a myth. And there's some deliberate mistranslations. For example, the claim that former President Ahmadinejad, who was hasn't been in power for more than 20 years, who was quoting Ayatollah Khomeini, who died way back in 1989, said that we want Israel to be wiped off the map, therefore that's Iranian policy. No, that's not Iranian policy. In fact, the phrase wiped off the map doesn't even exist in the Persian language. A more accurate translation would be vanished from the pages of time. And when Ahmadinejad was like that, he said, look at the map of the Soviet Union. Do you see it anymore? Mm-hmm. No, you see Russia and the other countries. In other words, they don't want Israel to exist as Israel. They want it to be Palestine. But that doesn't mean physically destroying Israel or killing the Jews.
And I
remember our big mistake in Vietnam was that we saw communism, and that's a totalitarian movement trying to take over the world. So we got to respond militarily, not realizing that first and foremost it was a nationalist movement. Mm-hmm. It was communist led, but it was a nationalist movement by people who were sticking up for their own country from foreign invaders and a puppet regime in Saigon. Similarly with Iran, we miss out on the fact that, yes, it's an Islamist republic, but first and foremost, it's nationalist and it's asserting that. And when we have these double standards, when we mm-hmm. have these threats, when we have these things, it creates this kind of reaction. And so the more we bombed in Vietnam, the more troops we sent, the more the resistance. And similarly, the more we attack Iran, the more the resistance we're going to get from them as well.
And I apologize. We only have 2.5 minutes left, but give us your brief answer if you can. With Hamas and Hezbollah weakened, at least to a large degree, allies tangentially at least of Iran, with Iran now hit at least to some degree, having less technology, and with the lack of Arab allies in the Middle East really calling this latest strike by the U.S. out over the weekend, is there a chance, at least a chance, that what Trump administration did over the weekend, and could this actually lead towards a larger regional acceptance of Israel and U.S. policy, and could this actually bring some sort of peace, or is that just unknown yet?
No, I mean, it's doing just the opposite, just getting more and more resentment at the United States and Israel. Even critics of the Iranian regime, again, point out this double standard, in terms of, Israel itself is a nuclear power, has over 90 nuclear weapons. Why? And so they really won't. Israel won't be accepted until they grant their Palestinians freedom, either in a viable two-state solution or in a binational state with equal rights for both people. I mean, and the failure for that to happen is what's led to the rise of extremist groups like Hamas, which came only after Israel ended up occupying the West Bank and Gaza, and Hezbollah, which emerged only after the Israeli occupation in 1982, that parts of southern Lebanon. And similarly, I mean, ISIS emerged after the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you try to when you invade and occupy, kill a lot of civilians, that's the extremism that comes up. You don't make people moderate by bombing them and killing them, especially when you have such high civilian casualties.
Yeah. Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and director of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of San Francisco. Amazing background, amazing knowledge. Appreciate you so very much. We'd love to have you back on again. Thank you for your time today.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. We're going to have State Senator Kelda Royce next, talking about things closer to home. The Joint Finance Committee, University of Wisconsin System. Don't go anywhere. It's the Todd Lavelle Show for a Monday on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. Come work with us. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
More money. It is a simple message that state legislators are sending to the governor on the Agriculture Road Improvement Program. I'm Pam Yonke with a quick update on what's happening in food and farming news on a Monday. The program was launched last year with incredible success. Basically, it's monies that will go to upgrading local roads that carry over 15 million tons of agriculture goods from farms to processors every year. Now, Travis Tranel, current chair of the Assembly Agriculture Committee, says the previous round of funding was at $150 million. Now, the governor proposing just $50 million for the program. And Tranel says that's just not enough.
Well, definitely make sure that if we pass a budget that we restore that $100 million cut to ARIP. I think that's ultimately probably the most consequential thing that we can really do for agriculture right now, because our infrastructure is just crumbling. We're doing more damage to our equipment on the roads in a lot of cases than we are in the fields, and I don't think that's acceptable. And $150 million spend, that's a big spend and a big infusion. So I would say that would continue to be first and foremost.
Travis Tranel, he's a farmer himself and also the chair of the Assembly Agriculture Committee. He cites some of the application numbers from last year's final round of the Agriculture Road Improvement Program, where 299 applications were made for more than $500 million worth of projects, more than three times the amount of available funding. Tranel says that's an example of why funding for the ARIP program cannot be retrenched.
Wisconsin soybean growers have a lot of choices when it comes to selecting seed varieties. If you're a seed dealer, help make their choice a little easier by shining the spotlight on your products through the Wisconsin Soybean Yield Contest. By entering customers in the contest by the August 31st deadline, seed dealers will receive $100 for one grower, $200 for three, and $300 for five or more. Growers must complete an entry and harvest form to qualify. For more information, visit wisoybean.org.
They say seeing is believing, and nothing catches the eye like the 7 bushel per acre yield advantage of Veltima fungicide over other fungicides. But don't just take our word for it. See it for yourself. Run a comparison of Veltima fungicide. Enter the Real Results Yield Challenge and experience the difference it makes in your fields. And when you share your experience with us, you'll get a chance to win a 2-year lease on a new truck. Sign up at yieldchallenge.basf.us. No purchase necessary. See official rules for details. Always read and follow label directions.
With all the action that's coming up as far as county fairs and continued activity at the state capitol, don't miss a thing. Sign up for our daily e-newsletter. You can do it at MidwestFarmReport.com. I am Farm Director Pam Yonke.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
A severe thunderstorm watch has been issued. High damaging wind gusts expected around 60 to 70 miles per hour, heavy downpours, lots of lightning, and hail is possible too, which could be up to the size of ping pong balls. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot. Right now, 78 degrees.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow.
When Republicans try to be cute, they always end up looking like Wile E. Coyote in the old cartoons. Governor Evers is the Roadrunner, and his veto pen is the Acme anvil that keeps getting dropped on their heads. If what they want to do over the next few weeks is not pass a state budget, it would be best for them to get one of those tiny cartoon umbrellas to guard against another Acme anvil that voters are going to drop on their heads.
Weekdays 6 to 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
Mark Sommerhauser, the communications director for the Wisconsin Policy Forum, analyzing the impacts of the big brutal bill.
That number that you mentioned of nearly $15,000 per person, literally about a quarter of the state's economy.
Basically a quarter of the state's economy coming from the federal government. I'm not hearing from Republicans in the state in their biennial budget planning any sort of contingency plan for major disruption in federal funding coming into the state.
The award-winning Maggie Dawn Show at its new time, weekdays 4 till 6 p.m. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, our friend and colleague Todd Alba will be joining us at 9:30. Audio Sorbet and This Shouldn't Be a Thing in hour number two. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings 9 to 11.
Better get out of the way, gonna figure out what I wanna say.
Welcome back to the Todd Alba Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. 35 minutes now past the hour of 2 o'clock of this Monday, June 23rd, 2025. Zommer is dialing up a little bluegrass there by request off of our next guest playlist here. She has been joining us, so kind to join us every Monday here through the budget process. State Senator Kelda Royce representing the 26th District, which includes much of the city of Madison here in Dane County. She is a member of the Joint Finance Committee during this busy budget process. Well, not as busy perhaps as we'd like. But Senator, first of all, welcome. How are you?
I'm glad to be here. I wish I was doing a little more work on the budget, but
I hear that. So first of all, bluegrass. You're in. What's that band called?
That band is called I'm With Her, and it's three women, each of whom is kind of an all-star in their own right, and they recently played here at the Overture Center in Madison, and I'm now obsessed and can't turn it off.
It's one of the many things I enjoy about you. You like music and different types of music, so that's fantastic. Sad songs right now out of the state capitol, if I can be so bold, at least in the Joint Finance Committee. You were here last Monday afternoon, and on Monday night, I was able to kind of break a little bit of news about these $87 million worth of cuts that were aimed at the University of Wisconsin. Well, I still call it system. They call it the University of Wisconsin now. By the Republicans on your committee, that leaked. Apparently, some people on JFC, Republicans, got a lot of calls. And they decided, boys, we better not do this. And they pulled it back. And we haven't seen hide nor hair of them since.
That's right. I mean, and, you know, like their cars aren't even at the Capitol. So I don't know what they're even doing. But, I think it's good because it shows that making cuts to our essential public services is something that Republicans know they'll pay a huge political price for. And so a lot of them just don't want to walk the plank. But the problem is the extremists are still driving the bus, right? And so they're in this kind of dilemma of, do they follow the extremists and try to get the votes on the Republican side? Or do they realize that that's a losing battle and actually try to save their seats, win elections, and be responsible governance?
Help me understand this a little bit, if you can. Maybe you can't, because I'm going to ask you about the quote-unquote other side. Our friend Trigby Olson, who used to work for guys like Tommy Thompson, Scott McCallum, before he went off to D.C. and worked for John McCain and others, he knows Robin Voss pretty well. They kind of came up through college at the same time. And Trigby on Wednesday pointed out that there might not be another legislator at the building that knows or has been involved with the UW system longer. Robin Voss was actually the first student regent on UW Board of Regents. And he is a proud graduate of UW-Whitewater. Steve Noss, Senator Steve Noss, a Republican, is, you know, a graduate of UW system.
Less proud, I would presume.
Probably less proud, but the fact is, I guess what I want to ask your comments on, your thoughts on, is as a former Republican, I just look at it as hypocrisy. I mean, even former Governor Scott Walker, who likes to call UW system a quote-unquote woke den of indoctrination, and then he sends Trigby Olson, our friend, Christmas cards very proud of his son graduating from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So my point is, these folks know the value of UW education.
They do.
They put their money into it. So is it just appeasing their base? Why are these guys, mostly guys, but I guess gals, mostly guys, just so adamant of making UW the villain?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the way they have boxed themselves in. You know, 15 years of gerrymandering has insulated them from the concerns of most Wisconsinites. It's allowed them to kind of ignore all the every single one of us in Wisconsin who would be proud for our kids to go to UW, any campus, and especially Madison. And when they don't have that electoral accountability, they will only respond to their base and the most extreme voices in the party. And of course, if they can do try to make a wedge issue, try to divide us rather than bringing people together, it's easier for them because that's the kind of political calculus that they've set up.
Yeah. There's a story just broke about a half an hour, well, broke, but was published about a half an hour ago at channel3000.com, the CBS affiliate. Headline here in Madison says, UW-Madison tells schools and colleges to trim budgets amid federal and state funding uncertainty. Read your first couple of lines. Dean and vice chancellors at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which senator you represent, will have to make tough choices in the coming weeks, university leadership said today. The budget cuts about the next fiscal year, rather. Schools and colleges will be required to cut their base budget by 5% of their fiscal year 2026 Fund 101 allocations. You can explain what all that means. All other parts of the universities that receive Fund 101 monies, including administrative, will have their base budget cuts by 7% in fiscal year 26 allocation. To the layperson, Senator, explain what all that means. And is this predicated on not having a new budget? Or what is Chancellor Mnuchin really looking at here?
Well, I would say this is basically the university being responsible and trying to figure out what are some worst case scenarios here. They're not just facing the prospect of not having a state budget, but they're also facing potential significant cuts in the federal government, cuts to student aid that really affect the most vulnerable students, the kids who probably have the most to gain from college, changes in international students. You know, for the University of Wisconsin-Madison in particular, we're a destination for the best and brightest all over the world. That is maybe not going to continue to be the case under the Republican administration in Washington. So they're looking at all these things and saying, well, we're going to have to make some very, very difficult choices. It means that student services are going to be cut, classes are going to be cut, majors are going to be cut, and potentially campus-wide, if you want to look at systems as a whole, we're talking about additional closures of campuses, right? Yeah. So if you're just extrapolating. So I think, you know, the state budget is one component of it, but just more broadly, I think there's a lot of challenges in higher ed right now. And to me, it's infuriating because I and people in my generation and older than me have benefited tremendously from access to higher education and great public education. And, you know, it is outrageous that we are pulling the ladder up behind us and taking those opportunities away from young people and kids today.
We're speaking with State Senator Kelda Royce of the 26th District of Wisconsin here in Dane County. She is also a member of the Joint Committee on Finance, better known as JFC. Senator, before we move off of the university's part, I would be remiss. We haven't talked about it on this show in a long, long time, but I want to get your take on this. I'm a little long in the tooth, a little gray in the beard. I've been around long enough to work, having worked for my former boss, Dale Schultz, Senate Majority Leader on the Republican side. I was in the building, as they say, when the University of Wisconsin system had a huge surplus in their rainy day fund. And Republicans who like to say we have to be conservative with taxpayer dollars, we can't overspend, they actually voted on something called Joker they made the university get rid of all of their right. resources. Explain this a little bit and why that is so important today.
Well, and we've seen it wasn't just then, right? The Republicans have done this a couple of times where the university knows that the state is not a reliable funding partner and has not been for a long time. I mean, certainly under Walker, but even before that, right? State support has really shrunk dramatically. It's maybe a third of what it was as a percentage of UW's budget compared to when I was born. So trying to, you know, manage that and be responsible, they were want to have a buffer. They don't want to be completely dependent and have to immediately fire professors and turn students away if the state decides to reduce money. But then Republicans say, oh, they've got a surplus. They don't need money. So we're going to slash it, or we're going to take that money and force them to spend it down just to keep the doors open. Well, you can't have it both ways, right?
Right.
I mean, either you want public agencies to be responsible with their money, and that means saving and having some money for a rainy day, just like the state has money in a rainy day under the current governor, several budgets in a row. But you can't use that then as a cudgel and say, well, then we're not going to fund you.
Yeah. Now, I just think the hypocrisy, again, of my former party to want, quote unquote, fiscal conservatism, which I'm fine with, but then to penalize the UW for being, right, for being fiscally conservative.
Right. Exactly. Because it just shows that they're not. I mean, right, you know, here's this so-called accountant caucus. We've had an accountant as head of our finance committee for the last several budgets. And what has he done but, you know, bring his school districts, the municipalities that he represents, to the brink of bankruptcy?
Mm-hmm. No, Senator's talking about Howard Markline, the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, used to be living in his district. He likes being called Howie, I guess.
Oh, I don't know. He never asked me to call him that.
I don't. I know somebody went to school with him. He doesn't like that at all. That's why I keep saying it. Very quickly, not quickly really, but we have before the first break, and I want to come back and talk about other things at the Capitol. Let's talk a little bit in terms of Joint Finance Committee. Are we really headed here, Senator Royce, towards no budget at all? And just keeping the same spending? And if so, what does that mean for some of the key issues that you're concerned about?
Well, we are so far behind on the state budget. I mean, it's by statute, it has to be done June 30th. And there are a bunch of kind of time sensitive things that we need to get done by then in order to get federal money. Right. So this could be catastrophic for all kinds of departments and state agencies if we don't get the budget done on time. More broadly, it means that our school districts and our local governments are not going to know how much money they're going to have to spend. And if we go back to what they were getting in 2023, obviously we've had big inflation since then, yeah, right? And it's not going to cover their current costs. So this could be really disastrous for all the public services that we rely on.
We've talked about it on this program. I know our friends Jane Mattner, Greg Bach, and Mattner on Air from 9 until 11 have talked about it as well, other programs. But what I'm really – I don't see one side, namely Republicans, talking about this. If there is no budget for whatever reason, if the spending holds where it is, that is still a huge loss for our child care providers in this state.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And explain why that is in terms of the lack of federal funding.
Sure. So for the last 20 years, we've lost over half of the providers in the state, right? We've got a situation where in the majority of the state, there are three kids who need care for every one child care slot. And the main reason is because it's very expensive to provide care for young kids. You can't outsource it. You can't have AI do it. There's no chat bot that will change a toddler's diaper and take him out to play in the snow. But And the amount that it costs is outpacing what families can afford. For so many people, it's more than the cost of their mortgage or their rent. It actually is more than the cost of college to send a baby to childcare, to a good, high-quality early childhood care center. And so families can afford it, and yet the workers are making poverty wages just because the economics don't match. This is a situation where there's a market failure and there needs to be public investment. So in the pandemic, when you saw just the bottom fallout of the child care industry, and everybody also realized, hey, this is essential. We literally cannot work without child care. And anybody who was on Zoom at that time knows why, right, you can't work without child care. And so the governor took money that was from the federal government, and most states did this, part of the ARPA plan, and put money into a program called Child Care Counts, which gave money directly to providers to bridge that gap between the cost of providing that care and paying a living wage to their provider so they were able to stay in the classroom and stay in the industry, and what parents can afford to pay. And that's what we should be doing.
So just make sure that I understand this as, in layman's terms, that we use federal funds during the Biden,
correct,
administration, and Governor Evers put that in place to kind of put a Band-Aid over what was already a problem,
absolutely,
with health care.
Now, yes,
now the Trump administration is seemingly ready to cut those funds off. If,
right,
there's
they're
no
running out. I mean, those funds are gone now, right?
Right.
So they are running out in a few weeks. And the last of them, I think, will be September 30th. So if, right, we don't put new public investment in from the state level, That's it. There's no cavalry coming to save us.
So even if your Republican colleagues are going home to their districts and say, well, we'll be fine because even if we'll just keep operating like we were, even if there's no state budget, that is a major cut to child care providers, correct?
It sure is. And they better talk to some parents and providers in their districts.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to come back, talk more with State Senator Keldah Royce here on a Monday edition of the Todd Allball Show. Don't go anywhere. Senate Republicans are okay with them holding or having guns on the session floor, but not other people. We'll discuss after this. Don't go anywhere on Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. Tuesday, June 24th is the New York City primary, with 11 Democrats vying to become their party's nominee for mayor. The election also features two major democracy reforms, ranked choice voting and public financing of elections. Five independents, two third-party candidates, and one Republican are also running for mayor, but are not on Tuesday's ballot. Nine candidates have qualified for public matching campaign funds distributed by the New York City Campaign Finance Board. Candidates for mayor must raise $250,000 from 1,000 contributors to qualify for a 9-to-1 match and follow disclosure and other rules. Mayor Eric Adams was denied matching funds due in part to federal corruption allegations. Voters will choose among the 11 Democratic candidates using ranked choice voting. One poll shows former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo with the highest number of first choice votes at 36%, followed by New York Assemblyman Zoran Mandani at 34% and New York City Comptroller Brad Lander at 13%. Mamdani and Lander endorsed each other, and as the ranked choice system eliminates the lowest choices, one simulation shows that Lander's second choice votes could go to Mamdani, edging out Cuomo to get a 50% plus one majority. Polls are open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. We have more on the city's election, campaign finance matching, and ranked choice voting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
At age 30, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, you can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Todd Michaels joins us now.
I have to give a shout out to Oshkosh. It's a very underrated city.
There was also a restaurant there I really liked. I don't think it's there anymore.
Yeah, the Tally's was great. I may have gone to like a prom dinner there or something like back in my day too, Pete.
A little calzone before you tear it up in the dance floor.
Man, there's nothing better than wearing a tuxedo and a little calzone in your cummerbund.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel.
The Trump administration arresting and deporting these supposed gang members without giving them due process is one of the steps to becoming an authoritarian government.
Dale, thank you so much for the call. And again, I second all of that. Bring them all back and afford them the due process that's a part of our nation, a part of this law, and a part of our tradition in administering justice.
Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Saturday mornings from 9 to 11.
Welcome back to the Todd Allball Show on the Civic Media Radio Network. 8 minutes now before the hour of 3 o'clock, coming up at the top of the hour. News from ABC and CBS, of course, updating us on the latest attacks on U.S. Bases in Qatar. The last couple of hours or so, we'll maintain our vigilance on bringing you the latest on that. Also, weather and looks like maybe a few storms in parts of Wisconsin later this afternoon and into tonight. Some may be severe, so be aware of that. And then a great sports reporter, Mike Clemens, followed by what's worse in hour two. We'll give Senator Royce a little heads up. We'll let her answer first. Our guest this half hour is State Senator Keldah Royce, Democrat of the 26th District, also a member of the Joint Finance Committee. Senator, quickly, what's worse, heat wave or cold snap?
Ooh, I'm going to say heat wave.
Really?
Yeah.
Why so? Why so?
Well, because, I don't know, you can always start a fire and warm up and drink some cocoa. And what it's not bad to be in bed covered in, well, in a slinket.
I guess I think I have to be outside. And maybe I've just become soft. But it seems like we haven't had one in a while. But like those Arctic, whatever they call them, things where they last for 2 weeks and going in and out of, I don't know.
No, I don't. I mean, I'm not saying I like it. I prefer just temperate weather, like Hawaii all the time. Why not? But if you're making me choose.
All right.
Yeah.
Fair. All right, fair. On to more serious issues. Over the weekend, another great program up front from WISN in Milwaukee. They interviewed Senator, one of your colleagues on the Republican side of the aisles, Chris Kapinga. And I heard Jane Mattner talking about this before. I've been mispronouncing his name. Dan Schaefer had it right Of course, he is our political editor.
Of course he does.
Right?
I mean, he knows everything about the Capitol. He probably knows what I had for breakfast before I even...
Yes, so Senator Kapinga was on up front over the weekend, and they asked him about security. You and I, Senator, talked about this last week in light of the tragedy, the assassination in the Minnesota legislature a couple of weeks ago. And they asked him in terms of security, and well, here's the cut from up front over the weekend.
Do you want metal detectors at the front entrances? What is
in? Yeah, I have not been through another Capitol that has not had a metal detectors. And it's going beyond that at this point. There are systems out there, and we learned this when we researched them, that will actually detect any type of weapon or dangerous object. So it's far beyond metal detectors, but it's gone now because we need to have a higher level of security just because of, unfortunately, ingenuity out there with how you can hurt people.
Do you also want guns prohibited from inside the Capitol or on the floor?
Yes. What Indiana, for instance, it's a great example that I bring up a lot, is that Indiana is extremely conservative and pro personal protection. So what they allow is they allow legislators to carry into the building for protection, which I always do. I always have been armed to protect myself, especially when I'm up in the front in the president's spot. That was, I just felt it was very important. But the general public, they don't need to have their weapons in the people's house. In the people's house, it's their representatives who are elected. That's the voice of the people. And I need to be protected as a public servant, and so does everybody else who's been elected into that spot. We should not be worrying about our lives walking into that building.
So you still want lawmakers to be able to carry inside and on the floor?
Absolutely.
State Senator Republican Chris Kapinga on the program up front, WISN, over the weekend. Senator Royce, reaction?
Well, I agree that we shouldn't have to risk our lives, but I believe everyone deserves to be safe in the Capitol, and the presence of guns by anyone makes us less safe. And that's, you know, that's not just true in the Capitol. It's true at the grocery store, church, schools, right, concerts. The idea that of everybody just armed to the teeth just means that you could end up with a tragedy or an accident that turns deadly. And, you know, in Wisconsin legislature, actually, I believe that there was, you know, years ago, one legislator shot another legislator. Of course, that was the Assembly, not the Senate.
Well, of course.
But, you know, it doesn't make me feel great to think about my colleagues carrying a gun, and maybe they just decide one day they've had enough of what I have to say. And, you know, nobody should feel silenced or threatened or intimidated by a gun. And, you know, we had a member of the Assembly who was the Speaker pro tem, Bill Kramer, who always kind of gave me a little bit of a weird feeling. And he made it known when that he was packing heat, and he was standing up at the front of that room. And he ended up later being, unfortunately, convicted of sexual assault. I mean, fortunately convicted, right, but unfortunately he committed sexual assault. And, you know, I just think nobody should get a special exemption there.
Well, and my feeling is nobody should be packing heat at the Capitol except for the Capitol Police.
Right,
exactly. And to me, again, it's the hypocrisy.
They're there to protect us.
Kapinga saying he can sit on the floor and have a handgun, but other people can't, like the general public can't.
Right.
I mean, it's either got to be one way or the other. And again, I for my former party that likes to say back the blue, to me it says they don't have any confidence in the Capitol Police
Absolutely.
To keep them safe.
And who opposed the expansion of concealed carry? It was obviously law enforcement. You know, my dad was a police officer. He was a state trooper briefly and spent his career in law enforcement. And he always said, you know, it's so much more dangerous for law enforcement the more people have guns and the more places they take them.
I don't want to see fourth graders lining up for 2 hours going through a metal detector.
And, you know, there's something really beautiful about having this building that belongs to all of us be open. I want it to still be open. Yeah. I don't want anyone to be able to bring a gun, but I want it to be open.
Minute left. My former party, the Republicans, seemed to be in a little bit of chaos or chaos.
Yes, it's a little bit of disarray. I mean, they've got obviously what's happening federally with this right-wing revolt against the right-wing presidency and a calls for the state party chair to step down even after he was just reinstalled. And then, of course, here at the state level, we've got a legislature where, you know, one party can't or one house can't count to get a majority of votes to pass a budget and the other one's, you know, trying to negotiate directly with the governor. So who knows?
Yeah. If you want to get a hold of Brian Schimming, Edgewater Pier, he'll be having a Diet Coke.
Oh, yeah. That sounds great.
A little hitherto unknown fact. At least that's what he used to do 15 years ago. I'm not sure if he's still there or not.
Well, it's not a bad way to spend the day, even soupy heat wave day like today.
You can always find State Senator Kelda Royce on the job at the Capitol. You can find her here on Mondays for the budget process. Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you. Stay tuned. What's worse is next. Do you agree with Senator Royce that the heat wave is worse? Or is it a cold snap? And we'll talk with Matt DeFoor on AI in media. Is Todd going to be replaced? We'll find out next hour on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The answer is yes.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio.
WXCO 1230 AM, W255DN Wausau.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
CBS News special report. Iran has retaliated for the weekend attacks on its nuclear facilities by launching a series of missiles against a massive U.S. base in Qatar.
They were successful intercepting this missile attack by Iran, and there are no casualties reported so far, at least, on the ground.
Military analyst Jeff McCausland.
The first thing they might well do is identify where these particular missiles were launched from. And obviously, if that's a fixed site, though it may not have been, do an immediate retaliatory strike from where that came from.
But it's not clear if things will go any further. Nations in the region are on edge, especially those which host U.S. bases like Iraq and Kuwait. CBS's Olivia Gazes.
Time will tell whether this is an opening volley or the extent of the response. We knew something had to come.
The Trump administration has been saying it still wants a diplomatic solution. There's been no response from the White House to today's attack. CBS News Special Report. I'm Cammie McCormick.